Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is off today. She'll be back on Wednesday. Congress makes a final push this week on health care. Speaker Nancy Pelosi promises that the House will pass the Senate bill by the end of the week. And White House advisor David Axelrod said yesterday that they have the votes to win. Not everyone is sure he's right. With me in the studio to discuss what's ahead this week on healthcare are Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute and Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
And joining us from the studio of the Washington Post, columnist and blogger Ezra Klein. Thanks for joining us, Ezra.
Good morning.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, Ezra, let's start with you. Is this a week? Will the House pass the Senate version this week?
I've written a lot of articles, Susan, where I began saying healthcare has entered the end game, and then it turns out there is one more overtime around the corner. So I've stopped saying this is the week, but it is the week they are planning to pass it. Robert Gibbs on Fox's Sunday show this weekend said, look, next week the person sitting in this chair is going to talk about healthcare reform as the law of the land. Nancy Pelosi says she's going to have a vote this week. And if they do that, what's important to remember there is that if they vote on the Senate bill, the House passes the Senate bill this week, that is done. That bill, barring some procedural trickery, is finished and the president can sign it. So you could, as has been true ever since the Senate passed its own bill, you could move very, very quickly to having a law of the land here.
You know, Mary Agnes, we've heard the president set deadlines before. Last summer, Labor Day, it has to pass by Christmas. Here we are almost to Easter. Do you think this is different this week? Is this really the end game?
Well, yes, because I think it will get even more complicated. We've got, of course, we're in the midterm elections. We're going to have a lot of primaries. Some have started this month. There'll be more next month. Congress is going to go away at the end of the month for a two-week break. So if they don't, if it doesn't pass the House, for example, by the end of the month, you'd have to start over again. We still have Senate action. Of course, that's going to take several weeks. Republicans in the Senate dislike that bill and want to amend it. But it's certainly, pressure's on, absolutely.
Well, Norm Ornstein, talk about what we should be watching for this week. They've got several things that have to fall into place to keep with this timetable.
Right. We still have a couple of key steps before the House can vote, one of them being that the Congressional Budget Office has to give its scoring of whatever package emerges. And then the predicate for that is getting the package with all of the different pieces. For House Democrats to have what they need to pass this bill, the numbers have to come in at least as low a level as the bill that the president had pitched, that the Senate had proposed. And there's a lot of going back and forth with CBO, tinkering at the margins here. But we have to get those numbers out. If those numbers come out and they fit, then we begin to move towards scheduling the vote. Before that, we get to the Rules Committee. And what Democrats in the House, a couple of things to keep in mind, Susan. The Democrats in the House, as we know, do not trust the Democrats in the Senate. This is nothing new, but it's at a more corrosive level than we've seen in a long time. They do not want to get into a position where they send the Senate bill to the president. The president signs it, and then the Senate just can't do anything more. So they're left with a bill they find obnoxious. They're looking at something that Republicans, when they ran the House, used fairly frequently. It's called a self-executing rule. In this case, they would bundle together the changes that come out in this reconciliation bill with the Senate bill, pass it, and they would deem the Senate bill as having passed and be enacted into law once that reconciliation package passes the Senate. It's complicated, it's controversial, but it may be what they do.
And, of course, the Republicans are arguing that you can't do that, that the reconciliation calls for you to pass a reconciliation bill only on something that's already been enacted into law.
That's something that, at least informally, the Senate parliamentarian Alan Fruman purportedly told Senate Republicans verbally. We still don't have a formal ruling on that yet. Kent Conrad, the Democratic chairman of the Budget Committee, who's a stickler in these things, said that that's how he reads the reconciliation instructions. But the House sets its own standards, And they don't necessarily have to follow along those lines. So they may do it in a slightly different way. And then we could get some controversy with the Senate.
So, Ezra, talk to me about who are the critical targets now among House Democrats as we move toward this vote?
The general targets here are conservative House Democrats. We're particularly talking about people who are in districts that John McCain won, particularly talking about freshman Democrats who are scared about their reelection because they don't have strong bases back home. But one of the issues with this whole process going since Scott Brown won is that the House is a bit more of a confusing place than the Senate. When it was Ben Nelson and it was Joe Lieberman, you knew exactly what they wanted. They were very clear about it. In the House, you have a very shifting coalition of people who may or may not be for the bill, but in any case aren't being clear about what would make them be for the bill. And in part, that's because what they're worried about are the politics of it, not the policy of it. They don't want a concession. They want to know they're not going to lose their seat. And the other piece in the House, it was different than the Senate. In the Senate, they needed everybody. There was nobody who could defect. In the House, you're going to have a number of people who are cut loose and allowed to vote no. And a lot of the jockeying you're seeing right now are congressmen trying to convince Nancy Pelosi that they're the guy or they're the girl who should be able to vote no, that they are in such a uniquely vulnerable position come November that they should be cut loose. And so having that play out, having these different folks argue that they should be given special dispensation to vote for this bill has made for a much more confusing set of negotiations than we saw in the Senate and made it much harder to say who exactly is the target.
Who, like for example, who has been given a dispensation and okay official seal of approval on voting no?
Well, we just don't know, but we can say, for instance, Artur Davis, who is a congressman from Alabama and is running for governor in Alabama. You can be pretty sure that he's not going to vote for the bill because it's essentially understood. He's running for governor in Alabama. You don't vote for this health care reform bill if you're running for governor in Alabama. So he's got a good excuse. People who are in somewhat stronger districts are probably going to be the folks who really get their arms twisted. Some of the liberals who voted against the bill last time because they felt it didn't have a public option are really going to come in under a lot of pressure. Essentially, the more vulnerable you legitimately are, the more they can see that you need help on this one, the more likely you are to get out of it. But insofar as, you know, a lot of people are just nervous and they don't really – it doesn't look like they're in a lot of danger, they're the ones who Nancy Pelosi is going to focus on.
Mary Agnes, you've covered Congress a long time. You used to be Capitol Hill bureau chief for Congressional Quarterly. What does lobbying look like at this point, the final days before a tough bill? What is it that the leaders or the White House can do to either cajole or threaten reluctant members of Congress to stay with them?
I think they're trying to send the message that if you don't pass health care, that will hurt you in your reelection, that it's better to have something than to have nothing. They can also look at provisions and try to equalize their impact, for example, on Medicaid. In the Senate bill, there was this outrage when it became clear that the Medicaid expansion, the government would pick up the cost of that for Nebraska in perpetuity. And so what President Obama did when he made his proposal it's been about a month ago, to try to spread that out a little bit among all states. States, for example, that have gone ahead and expanded Medicaid to populations that aren't covered, like childless adults, they may ask for a little more assistance in this bill. You've got members who are very worried that their hospitals might be hurt by a reduction in something called disproportionate share payments. This is money the government pays to help cover uncompensated care. They want to make sure that money isn't cut off too soon. You know, the thought is you lower disproportionate share as more people are covered and have insurance. They want some equal treatment in that. So they've got a lot of kind of local politics, if you will, to do with these members to say, we're taking this step so your district isn't hurt. And it's important for the party and important for the president for you to vote for this bill.
Norm, what else do you think is going on?
Well, there are other carrots and sticks here that go beyond what's in the bill, Susan. One thing we know is that the Service Employees Union, the SEIU, is playing real hardball with many of these Democrats. It's the most effective union politically for the Democratic Party. And they're basically going in to wavering Democrats and saying, this is the vote. If you vote against this, not only will we cut off funds for you, but we may encourage primary opponents against you. We'll make your life very, very difficult. All of that's against a barrage of ads coming in from the Chamber of Commerce and others trying to intimidate them. Then you've got the White House, which basically has made it clear that they are going to prioritize presidential visits and fundraising based on votes for and against the bill. You know, if you are a wavering, nervous Democrat, as Ezra talked about, One thing that could tip the scales for you is a presidential appearance at a fundraiser, which could mean more money in one fell swoop than you could raise in 3 months of the phone calls that members make every single day trying to pick off the money $2,000 at a clip.
Ezra, will there be a single Republican vote for this bill?
I don't believe so. On the initial House passage, you had Joseph Cow out of New Orleans who voted for the bill. He will not be there this second time. This is going to be a straight party line vote.
And I wonder, if this passes, it's a huge piece of legislation. It's one of the biggest changes in the healthcare system in a half century. Have we as a nation passed a piece of legislation with this kind of consequence along a strict party line vote before, Norm?
Well, one of the things we're going to be looking for here, Susan, is whether we get a four-hour vote at 3 o'clock in the morning, which is what we had when the House, on a party line basis, passed the Medicare prescription drug bill when the Republicans were in charge. And they played a kind of hardball. These votes are supposed to take 15 minutes. They played a hardball at 3 o'clock in the morning that got several members, including Tom DeLay, they weren't quite censured. They got their hands slapped by the House, admonished by the Ethics Committee for the tactics that they used in threatening some members with mayhem if they didn't vote for it.
Do you expect another, Mary Agnes, do you expect another 3 a.m. vote in the House with arm twisting going on almost in public?
Yes. I mean, I think that that's how difficult this is going to be. I was at that vote for the Medicare prescription drug benefit, and you could see members that, you could see them working the floor, going up to people. I think it could be another replay of that.
We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we'll take some of your calls and questions. 1-800-433-8850 is our toll-free number. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And joining in this hour to talk about this final last push on healthcare, Ezra Klein. He's a columnist for The Washington Post and Newsweek. Mary Agnes Carey, she's senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. And Norm Ornstein, he's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and is the co-author of The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track. Here's an email we've got from Joseph, who's writing us from White Lake, Michigan. He says, whether you are for or against the bill, everyone will be happy to see a vote. Afterwards, maybe the president will actually start work on what people want him to do, jobs. And I wonder, Ezra, this has been a huge commitment by President Obama over the past year of his time, his political clout on health care. I wonder if it seems that has cost him at a time people are so concerned about the economy and jobs in particular.
The normal answer you give to this question is yes, of course it did. That the normal critique people throw at the White House right now is a terrible economy. They should be focused on jobs. Though I would say pass a stimulus, and then in recent weeks, the House and Senate have passed a lot of jobs bills. But I actually find the counterfactual here much more complicated. There isn't that much the administration or Congress can really do on the jobs front right now, not unless we're willing to talk about trillions in additional stimulus spending, and we're not willing to talk about that. So in a world in which they didn't try health care at all, a world in which Obama came in during a terrible recession and focused on limited jobs legislation and then spent more time, I guess, doing foreign policy, you could as easily imagine a harsh critique that he's doing too little, that he had an enormous opportunity here to do things that, you know, people in a recession really needed, like health care reform, and whiffed it. So I have a bit of trouble saying what would have happened in another world where they tried things entirely differently. People, you know, on the other side figure out the critique that best fits the situation and then go for it. And I think that in a harsh environment like this, the president was always going to lose some popularity. And, you know, so whether or not it would have been better or worse if he had tried to do nothing at all, I think is very hard to say.
You know, Ezra, you make a good point, but I wonder, not that he should have not pursued health care reform, but the fact that it has taken so long, despite these big majorities that Democrats have in the House and Senate. Norm, do you think it was inevitable that it would take until now, or could the White House have handled things in a different way last year and gotten it done faster?
It wasn't inevitable, but they had two bad breaks here. One was Tom Daschle not getting confirmed as Secretary of HHS and chief White House point person on health. That would have accelerated the pace by several months. I believe if Daschle had been nominated or had that nomination move forward before Tim Geithner's nomination for Treasury Secretary, we would already have had a health care plan enacted. The other was Ted Kennedy's illness and Kennedy not being able to participate as a figure who could bring people together. But otherwise, the critique that they took too long, they were not going to get Republican votes. It became fairly clear, even in the negotiations over the so-called Gang of Six, that meant they needed all the Democrats. And to get a coalition from socialist Bernie Sanders to conservative Ben Nelson, you needed to take time to convince the conservative Democrats that you did everything you could to make it bipartisan, to get a very nervous Blanche Lincoln, who's up for re-election and in serious trouble. So I think this had to play out over a significant period of time. And of course, if Massachusetts had turned out differently, or if the timing had been different with that, we would once again be in a different situation right now.
So it's interesting, Mary Agnes, that the debate in these final days centers to some degree on the issue of abortion, even though this is a bill that includes huge provisions, insurance exchanges, an individual mandate. But the final stumbling block, or one of them, is certainly over abortion funding. And we hear conflicting statements on whether this bill provides government funding of abortions. What are the facts?
In the House bill, you certainly couldn't have any government funding abortion in the exchanges. You could buy that with your own dollars. You'd have to get a rider. It can't be offered. The Senate bill, they feel like they've struck a compromise that should give abortion rights opponents comfort. It's not a covered service, not mandatory service. It can be, but it has to be financed separately by the person who is getting that policy. It has to be two separate checks, two separate accounts. And Ben Nelson, this was a big issue for him. We were just talking about him before the Senate vote came down. He feels that's a great separation and that that is fair. But Bart Stupak in the House, who's a Democrat, who's an abortion rights opponent, feels that it blurs the lines. And so people will be looking at this and have to find out if they have comfort on it. And the other thing about this is abortion rights proponents don't like the Senate bill either. They feel that it's too onerous and too difficult. And what will happen is insurers simply won't offer a separate policy to cover abortion services, and that that insurance companies won't want to deal with it either. So no one in the abortion debate is really happy about where the Senate bill comes down either.
Ezra, what do you think is going to – how will this play out, this particular debate over abortion coverage?
Well, you can't change abortion through the reconciliation process, or so it looks. And what you're seeing right now is that Stupak's coalition, which originally was about 14 people, appears to be splitting. And he's sounding very pessimistic on his ability to keep it together. So a couple of folks, including Congressman Kilby, who was part of his bloc originally, have said, look, the Senate language is very strong. We're okay with that. What the House wants to do right now is essentially leave Stupak behind, pull some of his people out from under him, and make the deals they need to make to get this done. My sense is that when this bill is signed into law, assuming it is, the final language looks like the Senate language and not like the Stupak language.
Now, on Friday night, the White House was circulating a letter from Catholic and Christian evangelical leaders urging the passage of the bill. Has that had much of an effect?
Yes,
Norm,
it has. You know, Stupak has been saying that he had at least a dozen people who would vote against the bill unless the language were changed. I think that was a little bit of bravado to begin with. But right now, when you're seeing a significant number of pro-life, serious Catholic figures emerge saying that this is okay, it's giving an imprimatur to half of those people at least. So I'd be surprised if Stupak carried more than a half dozen. That still creates a heavier lift for Speaker Pelosi. Pelosi, because these are people who voted for the bill in the first place, and she doesn't have a huge margin. But it makes it much more doable. One other point here, Susan, that I think is often gets lost in this. There is a lot of government subsidy of health coverage of abortion. It comes through the reality that employer-provided coverage is taxpayer-subsidized, and most of that has abortion coverage. So this is fighting over something that is so tiny and symbolic that it still kind of creates a wonderment in me that this has become such a huge issue when they've ignored the big one.
Let's go to the phones and let our listeners join our conversation. We'll go first to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and talk to Dina. Dina, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to know if this health care bill is actually going to do anything to lower the cost of health care in America. I'm all about health care reform, but I'm also a pragmatist, and I understand that what health care costs in America, whether it's the government paying for it, insurance companies paying for it, if it's just, you know, too high, you know, it's never going to work. And I'll give you a very brief example. My mother-in-law was here visiting from another country, and she fell and broke her arm. She had to have surgery. She was in the hospital 2 days. They said it was a very straightforward thing. She had no other conditions to worry about. It cost $40,000.
Wow.
Now, and God forbid someone needs to have open-heart surgery. Should that cost about $1 billion?
Now, did she actually have to pay the $40,000? That seems like an extraordinary sum.
Yes.
Wow. Well, that.
What I want to say is no one ever talks about, you know, if I'm paying this out of pocket, it's $40,000 to the doctor, but what do I have to make in pre-tax dollars?
All right.
I have to make like $66,000.
Dina, thank you very much for your call. This issue of the cost of health care, how much does this bill address that, Mary Agnes?
Well, it's sort of an evolving question. I mean, I think there are people who look at the bill and they look at, for example, in the Medicare program, they want to link the payment for services versus to the quality of what's delivered, right? Instead of Medicare fee for service, you simply perform procedures, you get paid. The bill would, by looking at that, trying to put a link between those two, they help over time. That would control spending, and that some of those practices, if they're not already in the private sector, would trickle down to the private sector. There had been a provision in the Senate bill which the president would scale back, which will probably be further scaled back, this Cadillac tax, right? An excise tax on the highest cost health insurance plans. The thought was you tax those plans, they're very generous, there's less of an incentive to offer them, fewer people will get them, but he got a pushback, he being the president, and the Democrats from the unions. So that will be dialed back. Also in the Senate bill, there's an independent Medicare commission to make recommendations on Medicare spending that would go into effect if Congress doesn't take action. A lot of folks have pushed, members have pushed back against that. They don't want to relinquish their power over Medicare. So it's one of those things where cost seems to is a big issue. Will this bill do it? It will certainly reduce the deficit because the Congressional Budget Office has said that. They're going to reduce Medicare spending. And so the deficit will drop. But how much over time will we see a drop in health care costs? I don't think anyone really knows that for sure.
You know, just a couple of points to add here. It's always been a problem, a political problem, I think, for anybody doing health reform for the Obama administration. Costs are going to go up no matter what. What you hope to do is reduce the rate at which they go up. And the question is whether people would see this as positive when their costs are still going up. And on this front, Anthem and WellPoint, the insurance companies that announced just on the eve of some votes in these plans that they were going to raise premiums for individual plans by astonishing amounts this time, 30% to 40% to 50%, gave a great gift to Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama because they reminded people that without reform, they were at the mercy of skyrocketing health costs and insurance costs. So that may help a little bit in the short run.
You know, Ezra, when you try to pass a big bill like this, Americans want to know what is it going to mean to me? So for Americans without health coverage, this bill would mean a lot, make it easier for them to get health coverage and afford it. But I wonder, for most Americans who have health coverage, what kind of impact do you think they would see if this bill is passed into law?
Initially, not much of one. The big lie of this bill has been its size. Republicans wanting to believe they're wrecking a sixth of the economy. Democrats wanting to believe it's the greatest bill ever. The media wants you to believe you should buy our newspapers and watch our cable television shows. In reality, it's a pretty modest bill. It's much smaller than what Clinton or Carter or Nixon or Truman proposed. It will spend in the average year about 4%. 4% of what we spend on health care costs. But the big problem that the administration has had in selling it is that the coverage side of this is very well understood. We will pay money so that people without that much can have health care. The cost controls aren't well understood. You just heard Mary explaining some of this, and it's more complicated. The excise tax will bite down on high-value plans in the future, and the Medicare Commission will be an expedited process. It may work, and I think it probably will, but it's more complicated. But the one point I would double down on is what Norm said, that what we need to have here, in a way that people don't realize, are small gains that accrue over time. The Commonwealth Fund, which is a very good think tank, just released a report looking at what would have happened if we had put in the Nixon, Carter, Clinton reforms and they had just shaved healthcare cost growth by 1.5%. And if we had done Nixon's reform in 1975, instead of paying 17.7% for healthcare today of our GDP, we'd be paying 10.7%. It's about 40% less than we are. So you can actually make a lot of gains over time, even if the impact is only quite small, but 1.5 percentage points in our rate of growth.
Well, this is what I think they say is bending the cost curve, right? Just
right.
By a little. Do you think this bill would achieve bending the cost curve?
I do. I think that in most of what we have seen, at the very least, it's a good start. I've talked to a lot of healthcare economists about this, and they pretty much all say the same thing to me, that when you're talking about the types of things we could do to bend the cost curve that aren't just simply capping the system, going to single-payer system or something like that, that's very, very harsh and is not generally supported by folks, that this bill tries everything we know to try. It doesn't do it all at a very, very high level. A lot of the programs are pilots or this or that. But it begins everything that people think we should begin. And so the idea is not that you're going to sharply wrench it downwards, but that over time, as you figure out what works and what doesn't, you're bending it. And the other final point I'd make on this is that what you do in this bill, which is very important for cost control, is you create a structure for healthcare reform, these exchanges, something you get your hands around. And now suddenly it makes incremental cost control much easier, that if you want to begin working on pay on the way we pay doctors, you can do it somewhere. You can give incentives to insurers in the exchanges. If you want a public option, you can put it in the exchanges. It gives us a place to work on the healthcare system, which right now you can reform a system. But what we have right now is a sector. And that's a much harder, more diffuse thing to reform. And it has frustrated all the good intentioned efforts we've made thus far.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls and questions. We're going to go now to Eddie. He's calling us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Eddie, thanks for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. I have two comments. My first comment is, I don't know if this healthcare bill will fix the system or not, but we need something. Yesterday at 11 in the morning, my friend's family went to church. They wanted him to go to church with him. And then he could not go because his heart. I'm not going to blame this only on because of the insurance company. He was a little bit overweight. But he could not go to the hospital because he didn't have health insurance. Because every time he goes, it's a $40,000, $50,000 bill that comes in his mail. And he can't repay that. So he feels ashamed of going there because somebody else has to pick up that tab. And yesterday he was like, I'm not going because I think this is going to go away. And then when the family come back from church, he died. I mean, I'm not going to blame this only on the healthcare, but if something don't get done, I mean, this is going to be a lot of trouble. And last night I could not sleep at all. I'm at work right now, and I'm sleepy as hell. And then now, because I keep thinking about the same thing can happen to any one of my family members, because as you know, and like black folks and I would say minorities have a lot of obesities and you know, among them. And I have a lot of obesities in my family. Lucky me, I'm fit, but not every one of them is lucky to be like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if some things don't get done, I mean, we're going to be in deep trouble.
Eddie, thanks so much for your call. We're so sorry to hear about your friend. You know, Mary Agnes, we hear these stories from advocates for reform all the time about people who really suffer terrible consequences because they don't have health coverage.
No, and that's one of the messages that the president talks about this a lot and Democrats talk about it a lot, that anyone could be, you know, that you may have health insurance now, maybe your job, you have it, but you could lose it. And that this bill would give you options to get coverage if you didn't have it. And the other part of this is if someone is uninsured, maybe they're not getting physicals. They're not getting the medical treatment. Chronic conditions are huge cost drivers, heart disease, diabetes, obesity. The caller mentioned several of them. The thought is if more people get insured, you get preventive care. That could help reduce the cost and the growth and the horrible experiences you would have with a chronic condition that's not treated.
Now, of course, if Eddie's friend had gone to the emergency room, they would have been required by law to treat
that's
him.
Right.
But then, of course, you do have the consequences afterwards of the bills that can be sent to you. Norm, the president is going today to Strongsville, Ohio, to make his case. Why Strongsville?
You know, it's interesting. Presidents, and Obama is in a long line of them, read the letters that come in. Obama gets a sampling of letters every night and reads them. And he read a letter from a woman who has leukemia without insurance, who's, you know, just in a wrenching condition. It reminds you of Eddie's friend in some ways. And it moved him greatly. And it's one of the things that's been a motivator. And so he's going out there. This woman is actually back in the hospital with her leukemia. Her sister will be there. But he wants to personalize this, to dramatize, to try and change the political environment on the eve of the House vote.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back and take your calls and questions as we discuss the final push on health care. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org, by the Avis Family Foundation, supporting expanded foreign news online and on air, and by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
President Obama wants to double U.S. exports in 5 years. A State Department official explains how. The administration's five-step plan to expand sales of goods and services abroad. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Ezra Klein, I can't tell you how many shows and discussions we've had on the Diane Rehm Show about the public option, that government-run health care plan that has been in and out of the legislation. So tell me, is the public option alive or dead at this point?
Dead. And you've seen an odd resurgence in recent weeks as some progressive organizing groups have gotten a lot of Senate members to sign a letter saying that if the public option is in reconciliation, they will vote for it. But when I've spoken to Senate offices, they've said to me, look, we don't oppose this thing. We didn't want to say no to the letter, but we're not bringing this back. And then Nancy Pelosi last week said the public option will not be in the reconciliation bill. And the White House said we don't have the votes for it. And Harry Reid said, I'm not doing it if the White House isn't doing it. So what you're basically seeing is the leadership is saying, we do not see a reason to bring this back. But what you might see is Bernie Sanders has said he'll bring the public option back as an amendment to the reconciliation bill. And if he's able to do that, and then we will really see what we should have seen all along. Does it have the votes? Because you generally see opposition to the public option from the Democratic side. They just say, well, we don't have the votes for it. Well, let's see. If they don't have the votes for it, then the public option is dead, and that's how we do legislation in this country. If they do, then it will live, and that's also how we do legislation in this country. So I think it is not alive as part of the leadership's vision for healthcare reform, but it's like anything else. If it actually has a voice and somebody brings it up as part of the process, it can live.
You know, most of the focus now is on possible Democratic defections among conservatives, either because of budgetary reasons or because of the abortion debate. But I wonder how many defections they might suffer on the left. For instance, one reason President Obama may be headed to Strongsville is because it's an area represented by Dennis Kucinich, the very liberal House member from Ohio. Do you think we'll see very much loss for the leadership on the left, Ezra?
Not that much. One of the most encouraging things I saw for the bill's package in the last week or so was that Lynn Woolsey, who's a co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, and Anthony Weiner, who's a very liberal, very outspoken member of the House, for the first time were going on the evening shows and not hammering this bill. For almost the entire process of health care reform, they've been going on in the evening and pretty much saying everything that is wrong with the bill, everything that liberals would need changed in the bill. And that was because for a very long time, people assumed the bill would pass. And so they saw their primary incentive as getting the leverage to negotiate concessions for them and their constituencies at the end. And only in the past week or two or three, after the near-death experience of Scott Brown, have a lot of these folks come and said, you know what? What we need to do now is just pass this thing. Whatever we got to do, we just have to pass it. And so Woolsey was on there saying, look, Kucinich does not represent the rest of us in the Progressive Caucus. And Weiner was on there saying, look, there's a lot of good in this bill. So you're seeing a unanimity among House liberals, or at least among a lot of them, that has not been present at any other time in this debate. And that I think is one of the most encouraging developments we've seen, because it's the first time everybody's been, or mostly everybody has been, speaking from the same hymnal.
Ezra Klein is a columnist for the Washington Post, and Newsweek has to leave us now. Ezra, thanks for being with us this far on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you so much.
Norm Ornstein, so what if it doesn't pass? What are the consequences for President Obama if he can't get this through?
I think they're pretty dismal, actually. You know, they've spent a year making this a very top priority, and it's now a high-stakes game, basically. A failure takes you back to the Clinton failure, the meltdown in the health care plan in 1994. And, of course, that ended up resulting in a disastrous midterm election. It wasn't just the failure to do health care, but that had a lot to do with it, because it basically said to Americans, we gave this party the reins of power, and they couldn't get it done. And you can't just blame it on obstructionism. People aren't looking for excuses. So despite the dire warnings by Republicans like Karl Rove and Mitch McConnell, estranged Democrats like Doug Schoen and Pat Caddell, that if they pass this, it will result in electoral Armageddon, the failure to pass it is far more likely to result in electoral Armageddon for Democrats and a serious setback for the president as he tries to move forward with a set of additional priorities, from financial regulation to more jobs bills to climate change.
You know, Mary Agnes, we've gotten several emails from people ridiculing the idea that these Republican congressional leaders are giving Democrats advice to avoid passing this bill because of the consequences in November. But what do you think the consequences will be, both for people who vote for this measure and also for Republicans and a few Democrats who vote against it? How important will this be in the November midterms?
Well, I think it's going to be a huge issue because many of these members of Congress campaigned on health reform. If it passes, then they can say, as Norm was talking about, I delivered, I ran on this, and I delivered it. If they can't pass it, it's going to hurt them, it'll hurt the president. But of course, Republican opponents will seize upon this and use it. Mitch McConnell, the minority leader in the Senate, has made it very clear that health reform is going to be, in his words, the key issue in every Senate race. I'm sure that House Republicans feel the same way. So, you know, if Democrats pass the bill, there's a lot more material for Republicans to work with against them on it than if they don't.
You know, one thing I have to say, Susan, is they've actually ended up designing this a little bit cleverly for political purposes. There aren't a lot of costs that most people will see or effects on their lives once this bill passes. And there are a few very positive things that will emerge. They will close the so-called donut hole. Seniors who are the most resistant here, both because they're fearful of what will happen to Medicare, but also because they're covered and, you know, they're less concerned about others, are going to get some significant benefit. Children up to the age of 26 will be covered on their parents' plans. For a lot of parents, I know I've been in that position, that's a big deal. no pre-existing conditions for children. There are several things that will be of benefit to at least some people. And for Republicans who are saying that this is the end of America as we know it, if after this passes, if it passes, it doesn't turn out to be the end of America as we know it, the political potency of that warning may not be quite as great when we get to November.
Let's go back to the phones and let our listeners tell us what they think or ask questions. Teresa is calling us from Baltimore. Teresa, yes. Hi. You're on the
yes,
air.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm a longtime listener to Diane Rehm's show, and I appreciate the show very much. I just wanted to say that just before the show came on, they had on the news, they were saying, I don't recall who said it, but something about that if this health care bill gets passed, there's a danger of bipartisanship, something disappearing. Well, there is no bipartisanship in Congress now. It's really quite remarkable. I would have not said this 6 months ago, but I absolutely am convinced now that the Republican Party is trying everything it can do to destroy this presidency. And they are being obstructionist about everything. I don't have any illusions that this health care bill is going to be the be-all and end-all of everything. I think it's a tentative step toward improving things in this country. All developed nations are facing enormous health care costs because of demographics, because they all have aging populations. That is something that all systems, whether it's European systems or ours, we are facing this demographic cost of an aging population. I want to say that I have been really, while I shouldn't speak for other people, I know many people, including myself, that are very, very disgusted by the Republican Party.
All right.
And I think they put themselves in danger of rendering themselves and their party totally irrelevant in the political system.
Teresa, thanks so much for your call. Norm, what do you think? Are Republicans taking this hardline view against this health care bill because they want to destroy Obama's presidency, as Teresa says?
I do think that the Republican Party at the beginning of the Obama presidency took a strategy that they would operate like a parliamentary minority, vote against everything, put the onus on Democrats, and if Obama's policies failed, they could do to him what happened to Clinton. In the case of what Teresa specifically is mentioning, it was Lindsey Graham who made that warning. And I do think we have to give a little shout out to Lindsey Graham in this case, who has been very courageously working with President Obama on Guantanamo and trying to find a way to deal with detainees, on climate change, on immigration reform. So he has some credentials to talk about this warning. And we've got Bob Corker, who's been working very hard to get financial regulation done. But they are exceptions to the rule. And some of what we've been hearing, that these procedural tactics like reconciliation are unprecedented, are just a hoot. Of course, part of the reason, that they're using reconciliation is because Republicans have used the filibuster, even to filibuster measures which got unanimous support, simply to delay things. So any of these procedural techniques have been used many times before by them, and that's a little bit of crying wolf here.
Well, Mary Agnes, what about Teresa's other point, which is that after this debate, this whole strategy will render the Republicans irrelevant when it comes to other issues, too?
Well, I mean, I think that they have, you know, when you look at, for example, things that have passed the House that have kind of gotten stonewalled in the Senate, student loan reform, climate change. Now, you know, we'll see what happens with health care. I mean, that's something I think Democrats can talk about. You know, we tried to pass these things and Republicans stonewalled us, so it might actually backfire on them.
We're going to go to Dahlia, who's calling us from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I'm actually an OBGYN physician here in Lexington, and I'm very supportive of healthcare reform. You know, I think as physicians, there, you know, a lot of physicians tend to be Republicans and, you know, seem to be against healthcare reform, and I think that's really delusional. I can tell you that as a physician, I am paid to do more procedures. And I think that's a major problem in our healthcare system. And really, I try to tell my patients every day that I think the healthcare system is broken. And I'm so proud, and I really, really am hopeful that something can change and something can be passed. Because if people think the healthcare system really works, they are very delusional at this point. I've been in practice for over 10 years, and I can tell you I get paid more to do a surgery than I do to keep a patient out of the operating room. And that in and of itself is a major problem.
That's so interesting. Now, what do you hear back from your patients in Kentucky, which tends to be a Republican area? What do you hear from them when you talk about healthcare reform?
Well, you know, they, I think, are surprised about my opinion because, in general, for some reason, physicians seem to be against health care reform, which absolutely astounds me. Really, it's very much a conservative Republican state, and so I think they don't know what to make of what I say when I tell them that they're in a broken system, and they say okay, and they are very surprised about my opinion. But, you know, obviously, Mitch McConnell is here, so there you go.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. Mary Agnes, what do you think?
This is part of the conversation that has to happen on healthcare, not just on this bill, not just now, but as we go on. If you want to bend the growth and cost curve, you know, the growth of the cost curve, rather, if we want to lower healthcare expenditures, you have to look at how we're practicing medicine. That doctor's paid more money to do surgery than to keep somebody out of the operating room. That looks at how are we reimbursing physicians, all sorts of healthcare providers. What sort of, you know, how are individuals? How are we all looking at our health? I mean, it's a key part of the discussion. We talked earlier about how they want to provide incentives to Medicare instead of just paying by the service to link the what you get paid to the amount of the quality of the care that you provide. But this has to go into the private sector, and it just has to change how many tests, how many procedures, how many drugs. What are we doing, and how are we doing it?
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls. Now we'll go to Larry. He's calling us from Conway, Missouri. Larry, hi.
Hi, Susan. How are you today?
Good.
Hey, my question is, I'm trying to figure out these senators and these representatives up there, and they're voting on this stuff. At last count, there was some 34 states that say they will not implement this health care system. The state of Missouri itself, the state legislation has, or is in a process of passing a bill, so they will not participate in it. But yet you have, like, our Representative Claire McCaskill is still up there, and she's a Democrat, and she'll vote yes on it. How can they say that they're voting for the people if we're all saying, no, we don't want it? How can they actually sit up there and vote yes and you know, feel that they're doing a job for us? It's like representation. We're being represented without proper representation.
So, Larry, do you hope that this bill does not pass Congress?
I hope it dies. I think the whole thing, I was a former small business owner, and the last year with all the taxes and unemployment, and then with this coming down to us, we've closed our doors. We've, you know, with all their so-called stimulus packages, they said those jobs were in the cost of $285,000 a piece. That kind of money, I could have given three people jobs for 2 years guaranteed. But yet we were not, the small business weren't offering any of this. We just wanted to spend it on frivolous projects. It still haven't happened.
All right, Larry, thanks so much for your call. Now, if states like Virginia, we've read about Virginia mm-hmm. passing a law to opt out of these reforms, can they do that? Will this law still apply to them?
Well, Virginia is the only state so far that has had its legislature actually act in this way, and more than likely Governor McConnell will sign it. It's one of the things lurking in the background that we may very well get a test of the constitutional authority of Congress to impose a mandate on people to buy health insurance. There are, you know, some conservatives have raised questions about the breadth of the Commerce Clause in the Constitution. But supporters of the bill turn more to the General Welfare Clause, which is much broader. And, of course, we have other mandates. But the court may intervene. And if it's the Roberts Court, given the direction that the Roberts Court has taken, it's entirely conceivable that we could have a kind of challenge similar to what we had in the New Deal with a conservative court trying to block the president. I doubt it works over the long run, but it's something to keep in mind. You know, more broadly, Larry's point about the public, you know, what state legislatures do doesn't necessarily reflect public opinion any more than what Congress does. But right now, we know that the public is almost evenly divided on whether they want this kind of health care reform or not. And we know many of the opponents actually want something that's broader and deeper than that. So it's not a clear-cut sense here that what Congress is doing goes against the grain of public opinion.
Mayor Agnes, finally, what about those special deals that were cut, the Cornhusker kickback and the Louisiana Purchase? Are they part of this bill?
Well, we'll have to wait and see what the final product is. Supposedly, the Cornhusker kickback is out. The additional money from Medicare Advantage, the Gatorade from the Florida provision will be out. But Mary Landrieu, the senator from Louisiana, may keep her extra Medicaid money, and there may be some of the other Senate provisions that stay in.
Well, it's one of those things that's become pretty controversial because it does look like, pretty much special deals for a few people.
But in many ways, this is how Congress works. I don't want to sound overly cynical, but if I want you to vote for my bill— and if you need something in return for that vote and I deem that that's worthwhile, then that's what happens.
You know, Susan, for Mary Landrieu, let me just say, Louisiana does have a particular situation because of Katrina. There are states that have been disadvantaged, and doing something to bring it back to parity is not always awful.
Norm Orenstein is with the American Enterprise Institute, and we've also been joined by Mary Agnes Carey from Kaiser Health News. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.